Hello, friends. Welcome to this month's episode of the Courage to Thrive show, hosted by Reverend Dr. Robert Flanagan, an esteemed Episcopal priest who has dedicated his life to spiritual transformation and caring for others. He is also the author of several books, including the Courage to Thrive series, which inspired this podcast and video show. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent.tv, and we are also on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. You are in for a treat. This is episode 2 of Bob's show, and today he interviews Karen Swallow Pryor, PhD, a reader, writer, and professor who today will talk about the history and meaning of the beloved hymn, O Little Town of Bethlehem. This is also the chapter she wrote in Bob's most recent book, While Mortals Sleep, America's 19th Century Preachers and Religious Leaders Moved Public Sentiment and Shaped the Nation's Moral Character. Sounds fascinating. All right, take it away, Bob.
So this is our second episode, so it's the sophomore episode. So things can be, things will go sideways inevitably somehow with all of this. But I'm happier with me, and we get to talk about, talk about the person that you and I have worked closely with, and someone who's been kind of a shadow in my life for so long. And I'm thrilled to be talking about Phillips Brooks, the great 19th century preacher, the beloved hymn writer that we'll talk about today, and his work as a bishop in the Episcopal Church is also what he was known for. Died suddenly at the age of 58, and sadly, and is memorialized in places around Boston as well in Virginia. So here we are. Karen, what I'd like to do is start off a little bit background to let people know about you and about your journey. And if we can spend a few minutes just talking about, your spiritual life and that journey, and kind of bring us up, and then we'll shift as over to Phillips and his writings and the fascinating chapter that you wrote for us in While Mortals Sleep.
Sure. Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me. And it's a joy to be talking with you again. This has been a project that's been a while in the making, and it's neat to see it come to fruition and then be able to sit back and talk about it. So I am someone who grew up Baptist in the Northeast. So long ago, where there were lots of Methodists and a few Baptists, and then moved to the South and mistakenly thought all Baptist was Baptist, and became Southern Baptist, which is a different thing altogether. But I actually live sort of in the almost the backyard, depending on how you count it, of Virginia Theological Seminary, and just a few hours drive away. And so my journeys up there to the conference we were a part of and some others have provided a real education for me about Phillips Brooks and Episcopal history and so forth. And so I live in the heart of Central Virginia, where I moved to take a position many years ago as an English professor at Liberty University, moved on to a Southern Baptist seminary, have left there, and now am a freelance writer, professor, lover of all things English. My specialty is British literature, particularly modern, early modern literature, such as the early English novel, 18th century and so forth. And so I come to anything that's American, including the work of Phillips Brooks, sort of on the side, and am learning much about that. But I've taught much poetry over the course of my life. And so that's why I treated this hymn, which I grew up loving. It was always one of my favorite hymns. And so when I had the opportunity to study its author and study the work as a work of poetry, I jumped on it, and I'm excited to talk about that today. But that's who I am, where I am. And thanks for letting me introduce myself a little bit.
Yeah. Great, great. Yeah, and the hymn, O Little Town of Bethlehem. So that's, tell me, you did some really interesting work, kind of just culling, kind of placing the hymn in its modern context. And so why don't you speak to that for a minute and place us within that. Where does a little town of Bethlehem fit in modern understanding of, Christmas carols and hymns?
Well, I mean, culturally, you can look it up anywhere and it's going to be on the top whatever of whoever's list. It's just over and over identified as a favorite hymn. And of course, it has different versions, which I talk about in the chapter in the book, over the years, and is set to different melodies, different kinds of music. And I'm not a musical person. I love the hymn. I know the most popular version and tune of it. But it's, I think it's the one that most of us sing. But over the years, it's just had little bit of changes in the verses that are included, different arrangements of it. But over and over, I mean, there are different popular renditions of it, and it always appears in these lists. And I just don't see it ever going out of style or out of, the list of the most loved hymns, because it's just so powerful and beautiful, and theologically rich, which I know we'll talk
Yeah,
about.
we'll certainly talk about that. As my experience of the hymn is that there's two tunes that it's set to. One is St. Louis, which is familiar to all the kind of really familiar to the Americans. And then I think the other one is, I want to say it's Greensleeves, but it may not be. And that's the one all the British people are familiar with. And if you play the hymn with a British audience to the American tune, you ruin the hymn. And if you and as I've had British organists working in American churches who have played the favorite British tune, all my American congregants say, "You ruined the hymn." It's so the tune is so wrapped up as well with the words. And can you speak to that at all? And your understanding, because you did talk about the relationship between the Phyllis Brooks, who wrote the words, and also to his organist, his music director, who put the original tune together.
And of course, I mean, that is long before we have the kinds of recordings and technology we have today to spread the tune. And so I don't know, again, I'm not a musical person, so I don't know the differences between the tunes, but I know that it is such a beloved hymn that, of course, the melody, the music that goes along with it, is part of sort of the heritage that we receive in either place. And so the sentimentality that we have for the hymn is going to be tied up in the music that we're familiar with.
So help me understand or clear the air. There's a lot of Episcopalians are kind of nerd out and fight over this little detail. You did a lot of close research on Phillips's writing of the hymn and when he wrote it and where he wrote it, because it's the where that everybody kind of fights over because it wasn't it isn't I think you nailed down and kind of put to rest the Episcopal controversy over where he wrote the hymn. What was he doing? So will you kind of
Oh,
to
well,
that, if that was a thing.
I have to confess that I did not know there was a controversy, and I just went and did my research and presented what I found. So I hopefully I won't be stepping on any toes of any controversialists in this. But no, he I mean, the story, which really is pretty well documented, is that Brooks was sort of needing a break out of his own personal losses, and of course, in the aftermath of our nation's losses in the Civil War, and went on leave, and ended up, across Europe, and ended up in Bethlehem around Christmas time. And it was there that he experienced this stillness at Christmas time. in the place of Christ's birth, Bethlehem. But it was a few years later when he had already returned home, and was sort of at the last minute just writing a children's song for the Christmas Eve service. And so that's sort of the story behind the song, is he actually wrote just the words to the song, to the hymn, and then Redner, the church musician or organist, wrote the tune. And it was all done in sort of in a hurry, but it was based on the words and images were, number one, based on this experience that he had in Bethlehem, which was a profound spiritual experience in the context of this great personal loss and this great national loss in the after, and then not only the losses of the Civil War, but then the loss of the beloved President Lincoln. But these things had sort of rested in him for a few years by then, and just seemed it from what seems to me is just poured out. And the simplicity of the words and the ballad measure, and the images, part of that is because the song was originally for children, and yet out of it comes, as I try to show in what I wrote, is this profound theological depth and richness, which also in itself could be somewhat controversial, but we'll save that for later.
So just to get back, I'll give some background on Phillips. He in the late 1850s, he attends Virginia Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia, which is at that point a slave state. And he takes his first job in Philadelphia in 1859. Soon after the war begins in 1861, he's still in Philadelphia. He has a brother. He's one of six boys that that his mother gave birth to. They all lived to adulthood, and one of his brothers joined the Union Army and traveled to North Carolina, where he died. He died of illness, not of wounds. And he had to meet. His father joined him to meet his body returning through Philadelphia as it was returned. Phillips also, after the Battle of Gettysburg, soon after that battle, travels out to Gettysburg for a time. Does it's he's there on site for in helping, but he's not kind of officially on those records for very long. It's kind of like he went out. Spent some time there, came back to his church, but when Lincoln's casket comes through Philadelphia, he eulogizes the president there, and that really is one of the things that thrusts him the national attention, the eulogy that he gives, and then so later on he leaves Philadelphia after working at two churches and goes to the Boston area and serves the church there and then is elected bishop. But it is at this small, not a small church, but this important one of the two big important churches in Philadelphia at the time in the city center that he's at, where he does write this hymn for this kind of family congregation that he has
And so
there.
what's the controversy about where he wrote it? That's
So there's a question
interesting.
that he was looking out. So he's in the spire at Virginia Seminary, looking out upon the city of Washington, and is moved by that. That's what he's thinking of
I
it.
see.
Others is that he's in Philadelphia and kind of thinking locally there when he writes it. And then others are no, he writes it in Bethlehem. And so there was this open-ended question of kind of where did he write the hymn? And so thankfully we didn't introduce you to that controversy, pretty
No,
minor, but still a bit of different game. It's because you kind of helped clear the air. I mean, as a lot of things that we in this research project, there were kind of a bit of what we call hagiography. There's a lot of this history that people kind of said, well, Phillips did this, Phillips did that. There was a question about, well, was he really 6'4"? Was he really that tall? Yes, he was. He writes to his father's measured him at I believe at the age of 18 or 19, and he was at that point 6'3 1/4. He grows a little bit more. He gets a final measurement. He says that he's 6'4". He writes it in his letter. So there's an understanding. So those kind of things that we have that are like, well, was he really this or really that?
And everyone wants to claim him. But it's interesting because really, I mean, as a writer myself and yourself, I mean, we might have a specific moment when we sat down and put pen to page or open the laptop, but writing is a long process that takes place, you know, that we turn things over in our minds, we get it, take inspiration, and then when something comes to fruition, it might be a while later. So it's an interesting question that really is about the entire writing process. When was he inspired? When did he put pen to paper? You know, when did he maybe revise something?
I think as a segue, I was reading your Substack of I think today or yesterday on poetry on art, and you were speaking about that and how you really crafted the definition of art really well. I think you laid out for us that sense of, I think, beauty and what is it, that is everyone an artist, or is it, how does this emerge? I wonder if you can speak to that, and then we'll move into the artistry of the hymn, because I think, yeah, if this kind of poured forth from him, it poured forth in a way, as you outline the chapter, that are just remarkable uses of words and a real artist's eye to it.
Yeah, and so what in the Substack newsletter you're talking about, I was just, you know, encouraging everyone to live a life full of art, because art is really an expression of our humanity, and we don't have to be good artists or skilled artists. Some people are, a few people are, but we all are makers, and I think that's really the essence of art, is our attempt to make something and to make meaning out of our world, and it can be the smallest thing. It can be just simply, you know, writing something, communicating something. And then, of course, we have great artists who spend years devoted to developing the skill of painting or sculpting or writing long novels, lots of different art forms, but at essence, it's the expression of our humanity. Now, whether or not, and this is like what I say in the Substack, there is a separate question about how do we evaluate what is good art versus what is bad art, and that's an important question, but it's a different question. We are all made in the image of God, who is a creator, and so it's part of our humanity to want to make things and to find meaning and to make meaning through the things that we make. And it's really important, I think, to be aware of that aspect of our humanity, to celebrate it in ourselves, but especially to celebrate and support it in the others who devote their lives to perfecting that and to doing well at it, because we're not all good at art or all kinds of arts. So. And it's interesting because when we're talking about Brooks, who is primarily a preacher, that also is preaching is an art form, and it's also an art form that uses words. And so poetry is not that far off. And English history, in particular, and I'm sure American history is filled with, I mean, the best poets in English history were preachers too, and that's not coincidental. It might be something that's we've lost in the modern age, but it really reflects the nature of good preaching. It's carefully handling and artfully handling words, which is the same thing as poetry.
And you're talking about people like Coleridge or
Well,
not
or
Coleridge,
George Herbert,
Herbert, yes, yeah.
and Gerard Manley Hopkins,
Yes.
not all of them, but for a long time, of course,
John Donne,
John Donne, right? I mean,
yes.
the men who went to university, of course, were there ostensibly to become preachers, so it was partly structural, but it's also something we can still take a lesson from, that it's really sort of a similar artistic skill that is required to preach well and to write poetry or hymns and carols.
And we're lucky in one sense is that Phillips really he valued extemporaneous preaching, preaching without notes and without a written text. And we're lucky in some sense that he did actually put to pen enough of his own sermons that we have a collection of which we did address a chapter in the book on his preaching, and we're grateful for it because he often spoke extemporaneously, and there wasn't this sense of time limit that maybe some of today's preachers who are worried about going over 12 minutes because people in the congregation will complain, or somebody who's preaching for a television audience where they're going to do 22 minutes, and to fit within the half hour show. So there's that kind of limitations that Phillips didn't bother with, and so his thinking he could kind of ramble on, but there are times when he was very precise about his preaching and careful with it. So let's so you title your chapter as How Still, and what was interesting to me, and I you know how many Christmases I have sung that hymn, and I've always kind of thought of just how still in one way, but you unpack that a little bit. Would you talk about that?
I talk about really, for me, this is I say a lot about the hymn or the carol as poetry because there's much to say about it. But for me, the center of it, which is why I gave it that title, is that word and that imagery of stillness. And the most obvious sort of surface level meaning of the word still in the hymn, because of the context, is the stillness or the quietness of Bethlehem on Christmas night, Christmas Eve, when Christ was born. That's the surface level, and yet still is what is, in poetry terms, we call it a zeugma. It's a word that has two different meanings in the same context or the same sentence or verse even. And so how still also refers to the whole theology behind the carol, the theology, and even the personal experience of how Phillips carried this experience and this profound spiritual experience that he had in Bethlehem back with them, and was still or yet experiencing it, that peacefulness and the realness of Christ's incarnation, and how in writing that song about Bethlehem, the events that happened that he experienced, my math, 100, I guess, 100, less than 100 years ago, but he was writing about events that occurred 2,000 years ago, and these are events that still matter to the lives of Christians now, or still. So still means now as well as stillness or quiet. And the word makes sense in the context of the hymn, how still this experience of Bethlehem matters and is real to us today.
And that's I've been to Bethlehem once a number of years ago, and my experience of it would not be still. It was as a tourist, it was okay, we've arrived, we're out of the vehicle, we're with the tour guide and kind of rushing up the hill to the church. And then kind of w winding our way through, kind of con renovation, construction type things as we go through a door, look at this piece, look at that part. Okay, we're going to have a few minutes to go down into the and this is the Church of the Nativity, down into the area where we think where Jesus was born. Look at this, look at that, and then up and out you go. And it's not a still event. It stays with you, but it doesn't have that. So it's nice to think of that as he was able to experience it in terms of stillness, of kind of, and yet it does stay with one. It still remains as a profound memory, but the kind of that it projects out on that Christmas Eve to a time there's a longing that I think it touches on, a hope that in all the busyness of a rushing around of our lives, particularly in the as this episode is will come out right before Christmas tide, and so people are busily running around, but finishing up and wrapping up and getting ready for Christmas, that this hymn reminds people of that hope, I think, that's in there too. And I think we talk about some of the other words and phrases that really stayed with you.
And I just when you were talking about your experience of going to Bethlehem, I've never been. But Phillips r rode horseback there, and I don't remember how long that took, if it was like a day or a night or something. And so imagine how different that was, to just to be riding on horseback from one village to another, and how much more still that would have been, and things have changed so much in the ensuing century or two. But what I really marvel at in the song is how it is filled with so many simple words, like still. Most of the words are monosyllabic, and there are only a few words that have three syllables or more. And yet it and the words that he chooses themselves have such a beautiful sound. So he uses a lot of the poetic terms that we can talk about are assonance and consonance and alliteration. So a lot of words that begin with S, a lot of words that have melodious sounds and rather than harsh sounds, a lot of internal rhymes within the same line, a lot of and the poem even has some half lines, which much of the many of these devices harken back to the earliest traditions of English poetry in Anglo-Saxon poetry. He uses the ballad meter, which is iambic tetrameter, meaning that he uses the traditional English beat, which the unstressed followed by the stressed syllable. But if you think back to your days of junior high taking Shakespeare and you remember iambic pentameter, which is the word that everyone has to learn in English, that refers to a longer line, a line of 10 syllables. But the ballad meter has 8 syllables. So that means that the lines go a little bit faster because they meet their subsequent rhyme sooner. And so it goes along a little bit more quickly. Again, you could use the ballad meter to write a really rollicking good times kind of song, but what Phillips does, because of the words that he uses that are, as I said, those they tend to be monosyllabic, they tend to be have the sounds that are soothing, like the S sounds and the N's and the D's. And so every line is filled with these soothing sounds, internal rhymes, an interlocking rhyme scheme, which is typical of the ballad meter, and then these other moments that suddenly burst with like a longer word or a repetition that provides emphasis. That because and it would be bad craft or bad art to do the same thing over and over, you have to have some sort of contrast or interruption. And of course, the most obvious one is the word Bethlehem, which is kind of, is one of the longer words. And yeah, I have to get it in front of me. I was just, So I don't know. I can stop there and you can jump in.
So yeah, I was and I'm and maybe others are doing the same thing. We're kind of thinking through certainly the first verse, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie above thy deep
Deep
and
and
dreamless
dreamless sleep.
streets.
Sleep.
The silent stars go by, and in thy and in thy oh goodness,
Yeah, I know. It's so hard to
yeah,
talk about it
it
without
is
singing
the
it.
hymn
Yeah.
without
Without
having it right in front of us.
right.
And
And I
again,
do now have it in front of me. And
okay, good, good. Carry on, please.
the last thing you want me to do is sing it. So I'm not going to do that.
Okay, but we can talk it out.
Yeah,
The
but we can talk it out.
melody will come out.
Well, because I was talking about the sounds and the rhythm of the words, but the other thing, and this is where we get to the possibly controversial theological point that I mention in the paper, is that the entire I'll keep calling it a poem because I'm talking about it more as a poem, but the entire poem is an apostrophe, which is an address to an absent person or a non hearing thing. So an apostrophe is basically to someone or something that can't hear you, either because the person who's not there or it's a thing. And so the song is an address to Bethlehem, which is why some for some years debated whether or not to include it as a Christmas in Christmas carol collections, because it's a song to address to Bethlehem, not to God, not to Jesus. And yet, if we understand it poetically, we understand that apostrophe serves a poetic function. And in particular, this, Bethlehem serves also as metonymy, which is a, something that stands in for, a part that stands in for a whole. So the poem or the song is not really addressed to Bethlehem. It is on the literal surface, but it's addressed to everything that Bethlehem represents, which is the birth of Christ, which is the Christian faith, which is the whole thing. And so, because on a literal level, on a as poetry, it has this device, it could on the surface be seen as, oh, this isn't a hymn to God, it's a hymn to a city, and therefore it's not theologically correct. But we have to get beyond that and read it as a poem is intended to be read, and to understand how the apostrophe and metonymy function.
And so in the one sense, and I'm going to think this through just as a concept that I'm working on, is that there's a sense of Bethlehem being that source, that place of Jesus's birth, and in amongst the Holy Land, that it is it's this representative of God. I mean, it's the same, no different than the Psalms that are written to Jerusalem.
Sure.
And that city in the scriptures where in the Hebrew scriptures where Jerusalem is referenced, as you say, it's representing God there. And so Bethlehem is in its being is this site and location of the birth of Jesus, and it's becoming the being and becoming. The becoming piece is all that is hoped for in Jesus as the baby who becomes the man who brings his teachings and ultimately is killed by Pontius Pilate, and then resurrected. It's all it the arc of the story is both in the sense of being and its becoming, of its hopes and fears, that phrase at the very end that Phillips uses. So I think you're right. I guess I would certainly disagree with anybody who would say that this doesn't represent, it isn't pointing to the divine, in that in that sense. I mean, it
Right,
just
right.
is.
And I don't know how long that debate went on, but these are the kinds of things that Baptists tend to debate. So I don't know if that's more of a Baptist hymnal thing, but I think it's now well regarded and re understood as a Christmas carol. But what you just talked about is sort of points to the other part that I the other theological point that I think that the carol shows us, and that is the way that this Bethlehem functions as, this metonymy pointing to God, but also it is the place that Phillips went to. It is the place where Jesus was born. It's a particular place. He went in a particular time, and Jesus was born in that particular place at a particular time. The Christian faith is one that is rooted, that it is historical. It's rooted in something that actually happened. That happened, and all the other things that you just described happened, and yet the truth of those things, the significance of those things matter still, to go back to that word. And so there's an element of both the theology of place, which is, sort of a, it's not a, it's a very fancy, can be a fancy theology, but it's simply an approach to looking at how important place is in the Christian faith and historically and now. And also, our understanding of our participation in Christ, because so many of the words in in this hymn, especially in the last verse, when there's really it does become a prayer and an address. Not it starts out, O little town of Bethlehem, but the last of the four stanzas that we're discussing begins, O holy child of Bethlehem. So it does turn into an address to Jesus, the child of Bethlehem, and a prayer. Descend to us, we pray, cast out our sin and enter in. And this idea of entering in is an ex is an expression of what a participatory theology suggests, is that it's not just that God is immanent, it's also, or just that God is transcendent, he's also immanent, and that our origin, the origin of everything, is in God, and the ultimate end of everything is in God. And so this theology, this participatory theology, is so exemplified by everything in this carol, because Bethlehem is this place that existed and does exist in time and in human history, and yet it's the origin of its significance for our faith begins in God, and its ultimate meaning for us today or still is in the story that God unfolds through his narrative.
Yeah, I think it's, thank you for bringing up theology of place. That's a more recent development in, in theology, and it's worth thinking about, particularly for Christians who haven't always regarded place as important, that the Holy Land is important. But it's not as important as it is to the other Abrahamic faiths, and so it's the sending out and going out from Bethlehem that has been so important in the understanding of Christianity over history than it is that, well, this is the most important place. And I think today, as we look at a decline, a retrenchment of Christianity and Western Anglos culture, is it, and what do we do with these churches, these places, and how do we understand the theology of place in a time when churches are, some churches are closing, and there's an adjustment going on. So thank
I hadn't
you.
thought, but I mean, that is so important. That's so important to think about, because place is important, and but it can't be everything either, right? And so there's that tension that exists and we tend not to think about our own. I say we, I mean, 21st century modern Americans, places is less important to us in our highly mobile society but we need to remember, we need to think about how God has met us in a particular time in a particular place, and how he can call us sometimes even to a place. And of course, here I'm just simply riffing on Wendell Berry, another sort of theologian of place.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah. So, yeah, there we are, an American poet. Yeah, versus, yeah. Well, good, good. I wanted to give you an opportunity. You've published a book recently, and I give you an opportunity to talk about that and just give us a little insight into your latest work and to hear what that is.
No, thank you very much. And I've mentioned calling a couple of times, I think, in this conversation, and that is the subject of my most recent book called You Have a Calling: Finding Your Vocation in the True, Good, and Beautiful. And I do talk about place in that book as being among the many callings that we might have. And so it's a book that I, my primary audience, I suppose, is the younger people that I taught for generations at the college age. But even over the years, talking to more and more midlife people, we've just lost the sense of vocation in one sense, because we've put such an emphasis on work and calling, and the idea that work has to fulfill everything about our sense of meaning and purpose in life. And it can do that, and work is good and important. But also, calling is so much more than the thing that we get paid to do, because we have callings as family members and as citizens and neighbors. Those are all callings, in addition to the work that we do, whether it's paid or unpaid, or something we do as a labor of love. And so I just sort of flesh out a lot of those, the myths that I think where I confront some of the myths that our recent generations have been raised with, and that we've also wrestled with, and just try to point everyone to pursuing the true, good, and beautiful, because I think that's what we're all called to do. And I just think this hymn, though, again, even before I knew anything about Phillips Brooks, it was always one of my favorite ones. And studying it and writing about it made me realize it's because it is so steeped in what is true, good, and beautiful in both form and content. And so it's a beautiful hymn that is worth revisiting and looking at more closely.
Great. Well, Karen Swallow Pryor, thank you so much for being on Courage to Thrive today. Really
Thank you.
appreciated our conversation and joining us, and thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob.